Welcome to the Science Podcast for June 28th, 2013. I'm Linda Poon.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. This week, the response of soil microbes to climate change, using T cells to attack cancer, and what Voyager is telling us from the fringes of the solar system.
It takes 17 hours one way for a signal from Voyager to get back to Earth. And of course, if we want to tell Voyager something new to do, it takes 17 hours to get the commands there.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org. This podcast is also sponsored by Audible.com, home to over 100,000 audiobooks.
Perhaps best known for the inscribed records they carry, the twin Voyager probes have contributed vastly to our knowledge of the outer planets by completing flybys of Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune in the 1980s. Now, 35 years after their launch, they will soon become the first human-made objects to leave the solar system. Voyager 1 is now approaching the fringes, not just past the last planet, but out near the boundary of the sun's mellowing influence. Carrie Klein spoke with Edward Stone about tracking the signals that will indicate Voyager has crossed the threshold into interstellar space.
The two Voyagers were launched in 1977 on a journey to explore the giant outer planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. And the first flybys were in 1979 of Jupiter, followed by Saturn in 80 and 81, then a Uranus flyby in 1986, and finally the last planetary flyby was Neptune in 1989. Since that time, we've been on the Voyager interstellar mission, headed toward the edge of the heliosphere, where once we cross it, we will be in interstellar space for the first time.
So what has Voyager encountered since going beyond these planets?
The sun creates a huge bubble around itself called the heliosphere. It's the atmosphere of the sun, which is ionized, creating this bubble. And we've been measuring that wind as it gets further and further from the sun. We measure the magnetic field of the sun that's carried out by that ionized wind. And we measure the energetic ions, the things that are moving at percents of the speed of light and faster, which are out there in the outer regions beyond all the planets.
And Voyager has been cruising this region beyond the planets and measuring these ions ever since. And in the early 2000s, the signal reaching Voyager began to change. And on August 25th, 2012, it changed abruptly. What exactly has been happening?
It turns out that the solar wind is supersonic, so it abruptly slows down as it approaches the boundary of interstellar space, and a shock is created, like a sonic boom. We crossed the termination shock where the wind abruptly slowed down in December of 2004 with Voyager 1. And since that time, we've been in a region where the wind is turning so it can flow down the tail of this comet-shaped object we call the heliosphere. And things have been very uniform, very intense energetic particles, energetic ions, and a somewhat enhanced magnetic field. These were still solar particles and still the solar magnetic field. And then on August 25th, suddenly, the heliospheric ions went away, they escaped, and the cosmic ray particles, which are outside and could not get in, suddenly appeared, and the magnetic field doubled in strength. So something dramatic happened that had not happened before in our 35-year journey.
And I remember when that happened. Many organizations broke the news that Voyager had escaped the heliosphere. Is that what really happened?
We have three signatures we've been looking at. Inside, we expect to see the ions, which are from inside the heliosphere, the magnetic field from inside the heliosphere, and not to see the cosmic rays. Outside, we expected to see the cosmic rays. We expected to see the magnetic field from the galaxy itself, and not to see any more of the low-energy particles, which were from the inside and would have escaped. That's what we expected to see, and we saw two of those three things, actually. The particles from inside escaped. They've decreased in intensity by over a factor of 1,000 and were no longer observable. The cosmic rays, which we had not been able to observe, suddenly appeared and could be measured for the first time, the most intense cosmic rays that we had seen in our journey. But turns out the magnetic field did not change direction. And we expected that the magnetic field outside would be in a different direction than inside. So it appears that we are still on the solar magnetic field, but it's now well connected, sort of like a magnetic highway, so that the particles can get in and out very easily. But we're still on the solar magnetic field.
So we're not out of the heliosphere just yet. We're just in a region where those heliospheric particles just seem to have disappeared. So in this week's Science, we're publishing three papers about the Voyager mission and this depleted zone that is still within the heliosphere. How do these three papers all contribute to this finding?
Each article deals with one of these three criteria we were looking at, that is looking at the particles on the inside, and we saw those abruptly disappear, decreased in intensity very rapidly by more than a factor of 1,000 and became no longer measurable. Another paper looked not only at those particles, but also looked at the cosmic rays, which had not been observed. The high-energy cosmic rays can be observed inside quite easily. They were discovered here at Earth 100 years ago, but the low-energy ones are swept out by the wind from the sun and can't get in. Suddenly, they appeared. Then two of the papers report on the appearance of these particles from the outside. So those were two of the three signatures. The third paper looked at the magnetic field very carefully and found that at exactly the same time when the particle from inside disappeared and the particles from the outside appeared, the magnetic field doubled in intensity, strength, just like that. But the direction did not change. It's just as though the solar field had become compressed, but we had not yet crossed into the interstellar region where the interstellar field would be in a different direction.
And what would give rise to this so-called magnetic highway?
Well, this is what we don't really know, is why the particles disappeared. But it must be because somehow the solar magnetic field, which is in a huge spiral around the sun, because the sun rotates as the field is carried out, it wraps into a huge spiral. And that somehow the ends of that spiral had become connected, or at least accessible to particles on the inside to leave and for the particles on the outside to enter, sort of like a magnetic highway with things inside streaming out and the particles outside streaming in.
So Voyager was launched in 1977, a generation before many of the satellites and probes that we've now sent all around the solar system. So how has its technology stood the test of time? Has it been able to detect and measure everything that it set out to do?
The Voyager spacecraft, of course, is early 1970s technology. The computers on it have only something like 8,000 words of memory. And there are three such computers that fly the spacecraft. The transmitter on the spacecraft transmits 23 watts of radio signal. So the signal is very, very weak when it reaches the Earth. And so we transmit data very slowly, only 160 bits per second. Another reason the spacecraft has lasted so long is we've had redundant systems so that as the first system would wear out or fail in some way, we could switch to our backups. And we've been running on our backup systems now for the last several years, but the first systems lasted for several decades, so I don't think we have any concern about the spacecraft wearing out, although things could break. We hope that we would reach interstellar space, and I think there's a good chance we will. The spacecraft has got a very simple power supply. It's natural radioactive decay of plutonium-238. It just generates heat, which is converted to electricity with thermocouples. It has an 88-year half-life, so every 88 years we have half as much power. So that means we know fairly accurately that we will keep all the current science instruments on until about 2020, when we'll have to turn off the first one. We don't know which that will be. And then by 2025, the power will have decayed enough that we'll have to turn off our last instrument. So we still have, hopefully, a good part of the journey left.
And after 35 years, Voyager is really way out there at this point.
It really is quite remarkable. 11 billion miles out, 124 astronomical units. The Earth is one astronomical unit from the sun. Neptune's at 30 astronomical units, and Voyager 1 today is 124.5 astronomical units.
And how long does it take for data to travel from Voyager back to the Earth?
Now it takes 17 hours one way for a signal from Voyager to get back to Earth. And of course, if we want to tell Voyager something new to do, it takes 17 hours to get the commands there.
So do you have any ideas now on when Voyager will reach the edge of the heliosphere?
This is a totally new region. It really was not a region that was predicted by any of our models, this magnetic highway. And so we don't really know how wide it is. So it could be several more months. It could actually be several more years. We don't know. This region is new and has this unusual property, which we did not expect, where the particles seem to have exchanged places, if you like, but the magnetic field is still that of the sun.
Ed Stone, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Edward Stone speaking with Science's Carrie Klein about the latest measurements from Voyager 1. You can read three papers by Stone and colleagues at www.scienceexpress.org.
Hey, podcast listeners. This week's show is sponsored by Audible, and right now they're offering you a special deal. If you go to audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag, you can get a free audiobook of your choice.
And if you're looking for any ideas, I can recommend something to go with this week's segment on the Voyager mission. NASA Voyager Space Sounds. It's a recording of the sounds captured by the probes as they streak through space.
So, check out that recording and more from Audible. And don't forget, you can get a free download just for signing up at audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag. When it comes to studying the impact of climate change, most scientists focus on macroorganisms, the displacement of animal species, declining biodiversity, and even our own health. But what happens at the microscopic level? I spoke with Fran Garcia-Pichel on how two keystone species in microbial communities responsible for keeping the soil stable and fertile respond to temperature changes and what that means for future studies of desert ecosystems across the globe.
Essentially, what we did in this work was we were monitoring the presence of microbes in desert soils. And what we found out that for a particular type of community called soil crust that is very common and important to the ecosystem, we found that there were two major cyanobacteria that were very abundant, and they seemed to be replacing each other from north to south. We then found out that this was due essentially to a niche separation whereby one prefers warmer climate and the other prefers colder climates. In view of data regarding changes in temperature that are predicted for the region, we could then predict that the southern microbe will replace in time the northern microbe. And so this creates a first case scenario for a replacement of microbial species due to temperature.
Can you explain to us what are biological soil crusts and what roles do they play in the delicate dryland ecosystems?
Right. So biological soil crusts are essentially assemblages of microorganisms that grow on the top of the soil in areas where there is no plant cover. Normally, plant litter would cover the surface of the soil, and so light cannot penetrate all the way to the mineral particles. But if there is no plant litter, because there are no plants, then light arrives to the top of the soil. The top of the soil then can sustain photosynthetic organisms in the soil themselves, algae, cyanobacteria of these types, and that creates a mantle of biofilm of microbes intermixed with the top of the soil, and this essentially creates the soil crust. And there, they serve a variety of purposes. In fact, these communities have not been studied very long, so it's only in the last, say, 10, 20 years that people have started paying attention. But we know for sure that they serve a very important role in arid lands in maintaining the stability of soils, in preventing erodibility of soils, preventing erosion of the soil surface. Once you have a community of this kind over a soil, the soil can essentially resist hurricane force winds with no problem without getting a dust storm going, which is what happens otherwise if you destroy the natural biocrust of the deserts. So that's one of the main areas. The other ones have to do with fertility. Many of these organisms are able to fix carbon from the atmosphere. They are photosynthetic, but they also fix nitrogen. They help also release other nutrients from the dust inputs. And so in this way, they release all of these nutrients to the infiltrating or runoff waters, which in this process become enriched with those nutrients. So in a way, they're mantles of fertility for the desert ecosystem.
Now, why did you focus on the two specific cyanobacteria species in your study?
Right. There is two species, Microcolius vaginatus. That's the species that's more northern and cold-loving. And Microcolius thinstrupii would be the other one, which is the southernmost species. That's the warm-loving microbe. We didn't really focus on those two cyanobacteria. They found us. We were interested in, first of all, to know who's there and are there any geographic distributions of these microbes, because when we try to help recover these important ecosystems, we don't want to start putting the wrong microbes in the wrong place. So we went out just to see who was out there. when we started looking at the data, we realized we knew that one of the two microbes was very important. We knew that before. The other one we knew, but we didn't know that it was very important. But when we look at the whole data for the whole survey across the Western U.S., we realized, these two organisms are the most common microorganisms in the crust. Not only that, they are the two that are the most important because they are what we call the keystone microbes. Keystone is a microbe that's more important than you would surmise from its relative contribution. That's the idea. So we realize that these two organisms are very crucial because they are the pioneer. Before you have the formation of crust on the soil, these are the first organisms that start colonizing, and all the other ones follow. And so these two are the ones that, because of their particular adaptations in terms of morphology, in terms of behavior, they are in a position to be the pioneers of crust formation.
Okay. And what does your study predict will happen to the distribution of these two microorganism communities as a result of global climate change, or, as you call your hypothesis, temperature segregation?
Right. As I mentioned before, what we could predict is that the cold loving is going to start losing a grip on some of the northern sites as the temperatures rise. If we put all of our data together of distribution and the characterization that we did with cultures in the lab trying to figure out their temperature preferences and so on, the prediction is that the southern dominant organism will replace the cold loving organisms in the northern site. And the importance of this is that the northern organism, the cold-loving organism, is the one we thought prior to this study that was the most common and important. So we knew something about these organisms. We had studied it with respect to its capabilities, to its genomic makeup. We had studied its behavior. So we knew a fair bit about it. But we didn't realize that the other one was so important. So as this replacement happens, we realize we're in a very bad position to predict what the consequences of this replacement will be, because we just don't know very well this newcomer into the stage.
So can you talk a little bit about how you tested this temperature sensitivity?
If we were thinking about replacement sort of animal species or plant species, these are studies that have been done for many years because it's easy to count them, to see where they are, to distinguish them. So you can actually make the distributions. You can describe them relatively easily. With microbes, that's a big problem. In order to find out that one microbe is somewhere, we have to use sort of CSI-like DNA-based methods that are very involved. So the big problem is to find out if the organisms have a distribution. Now, once you find out, and unlike with plants or animals, it's relatively easy to ask questions of those microorganisms if you can culture them. Fortunately, these two types of organisms are culturable, and so we, like good microbiologists, we get cultures going and we test them in the lab. So we did do exactly that. We did culture experiments in which we got these organisms out of the field, cultivate them in the lab, make sure of their identity by checking their DNA so we know if they were from one or the other type. And then once we had the cultures, then we can measure the growth rate or other parameters like that are, tell you something about their health as a function of the temperature that we could grow them in the lab. And so that's when we found out that all of the isolates, all of the cultures that we got of one type were cold-loving and could not take heat very well, whereas the reverse was true for the cultures belonging to the southern dominating microbe.
Mm-hmm. Now, your study looks specifically at bacterial diversity across a range of North American desert soils. How does your study apply to drylands across the globe?
Well, one can never say for sure because we haven't done it. We think that the distribution of the organisms, when we talk about microbes, are not so much restricted by dispersal, say they're all relegated to one continent, but they're rather the result of selection in situ because of climate or geochemistry or local conditions. So we don't think that the dispersal is limited by geography. So the prediction would be that this would be true elsewhere as well.
All right. Ferran Garcia-Pichel, thanks for talking with me.
All right. Thank you very much.
Ferran Garcia-Pichel writes about the distribution of keystone cyanobacteria in topsoil microbial communities in this week's Science.
Doctors can tailor the dose of a drug for people at different ages or by severity of symptom. But medicine can get a lot more personal than that. I spoke with Jennifer Cousin-Frankel about a personalized technique for fighting cancer, genetically engineering immune cells from specific patients in order to target cancer in those same patients.
There were a few different elements that drew me to the story. One is that the therapy has gotten a lot of attention, and the results have been quite dramatic, even though it's still very early. Doctors have managed to treat some very advanced cancers, and as far as we can tell so far, they've been pretty successful. So that's impressive in itself. I was also interested in this treatment because it's very unusual. It's a personalized treatment, which means that a new batch is made for every patient, and that's very difficult to do and quite expensive. And I was curious, you know, sort of balancing what's looking like a very promising, effective treatment against the manufacturing challenges and how to make this more broadly available to everyone. So I felt there was an interesting tension here between the scientific results, which look quite hopeful, and the realities of making this a practical cancer therapy or even testing it in larger groups of patients to determine how successful it's really going to be.
All right. You're focusing on this treatment, but you also narrow in on a group based at UPenn. Can you talk about that group and why you chose them?
Absolutely. I do focus quite a lot on a group that's based at the University of Pennsylvania, led by Dr. Carl June, who's an oncologist and a researcher. And I was drawn to this group for a few reasons. One is that although they were not the first to test this treatment in patients, they did have some very spectacular results, which were published in the summer of 2011 in three people with a form of chronic leukemia. Those have been really widely disseminated and gotten a lot of attention. And so I was interested in, you know, who are these people doing this research at Penn, and also how has this success affected them? How have they kind of navigated all the attention that they have received and the pressure on them to push this therapy forward?
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about this therapy. What makes it unique?
Sure. So this is a therapy that goes by a somewhat unwieldy name of CAR T-cell therapy. And so doctors take a patient, and right now they're mainly treating people with certain blood cancers, mm-hmm. like leukemia and some lymphomas. And they take T cells out of the patient, they take some blood from the patient, and then they separate out the T cells, and they genetically modify those cells in the lab outside of the patient so that the cells will target a molecule, a protein that is on the leukemia cells. Mm-hmm. And then they grow the cells up, and then they put the cells back into the patient. And so the idea is that you've got these personalized T cells from that particular individual who has cancer, you put them back in once they've been engineered, and they're supposed to really chase after the cancer cells and destroy them. So it's sort of combining a few different types of therapy. It's the gene therapy, although the genetic modifications happen outside of the person's body. That's one piece. It's what's called an immunotherapy, which means it's trying to kind of harness the immune system to fight cancer, and it's also highly personalized mm-hmm. because every patient's therapy is their own. You can't just create T cells and give them to everybody. It's sort of a unique batch for each patient.
As you say, this is very personalized, and it's also very expensive. The first treatment, those first three patients you mentioned, it cost $350,000 to do that treatment. So the cost has come down a bit, but can you talk about what's making it so expensive and how a manufacturer might actually approach this?
Definitely. So the costs are really fluid right now. And as you say, they have come down a lot. It's sort of in the range of $20,000 to $40,000 per patient for the cells, not including other supportive care that patients need to get sometimes when they receive the cells. There are different reasons why the cost is high. One is just that it is so personalized. You have to have individual scientists, you know, working on each batch of cells and growing them up and doing the genetic engineering of those cells. It takes about 3 weeks from the time you take the blood from the patient until you put the cells back in for that whole process to happen. So you think there's not necessarily active work going on throughout that time, because there might be times when the cells are just kind of left to grow and expand, but it's a pretty labor-intensive process. And also, because it involves gene therapy, there are certain requirements to do a lot of testing of the cells to make sure that they look and behave the way they're supposed to. Now, it's possible as this therapy is developed and is tested in more and more people, that the costs will hopefully come down. I think that is the expectation. We don't know, of course, if that's going to happen, but that's what people are hoping. And I think the reason for that is that people are working, particularly companies are working, to really automate how this happens and try and, in a sense, take the scientists out of the equation, do this as much in an automated fashion as they can. Mm-hmm. And that would certainly save a lot of money. It's possible there may be ways to shorten the whole process, which could also potentially save some money. So there are different ways to do this, but it's really still a work in progress.
So this is a work in progress, but is it also a success story? How many people have actually gotten better from this?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think right now we're kind of in the midst of this. It's been a success story for some patients. There is no question about that. There have been patients treated over the last few years who were out of options. They had no other available treatments for their cancer. They had not responded to various treatments like a bone marrow transplant and other aggressive therapies, and so they enrolled in this trial as kind of a last-ditch effort to be saved, and they were saved, at least for the moment. There are certainly patients who are in remission right now and who, as far as doctors can tell, you know, don't have a trace of cancer in their body that can be detected. Mm-hmm. Now, we don't know how long those remissions are going to last, and we're also still figuring out in what percentage of people this does work. There are certainly people who do not respond to the therapy or who maybe respond partially where it might beat back some of the cancer, but they still have cancer in their body. So there's, as often happens with different treatments, there's a range. And a lot of these cases also haven't been reported publicly because they're still very recent. People are still being actively treated. So the very first three patients who were treated by the Penn Group in the summer of 2010, two of those three are still in remission today, and that's now almost 3 years later. One patient was able to only get to a kind of a partial remission, and that man did die. There are also children being treated, and some of them are in remission. Some of them have not responded. So it's a mix, and I think the jury's still out on what percentage are going to respond and how long the responses will last.
Mm-hmm. And these cells are reintroduced into a person. Do they continue to grow forever? Will they always have these T cells on the prowl for the cancer?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think, you know, these patients are all still being monitored, even the ones who were treated a few years back, to better understand what the T cells do in their body. I don't think that the T cells stay sort of activated in the way that they are when they are initially put back in, but they are still in the bodies of these patients. We do still see them in the ones who were treated a little while back. And again, that's a really small sample size. Another thing that's been interesting about this therapy, and particularly about what the Penn Group has been able to achieve, the group at the University of Pennsylvania, is that their sort of construct, their T cells, the way that they modify the T cells, the way they introduce new DNA into the T cells, has somehow, and they don't entirely understand why this is happening, but it's led to their T cells dividing, proliferating really wildly once they get inside a person's body. So they put them in the body, and the T cells seem to really grow and divide. That makes them, as far as we can tell, maybe more powerful against the cancer cells because there are more of them. They're not just disappearing, which has been a struggle for a lot of people working on cell therapy like this, is to keep the cells you put in alive and to keep them there, not to have them just disappear. And that's one reason why this therapy has worked the way it has in these patients, is because the cells aren't disappearing and even, you know, they're even proliferating.
So this type of therapy so far has been applied to blood cancers. Is there any inkling that it might be applied to different kinds of cancers? Could they have a different target?
That's a really open question right now, and it's definitely something that people are looking at. The company Novartis signed an agreement with the University of Pennsylvania to license rights to the therapy that Penn has developed, and there are other groups working with other academic physicians, and that's certainly something that the companies and the academic oncologists want to answer. So they are just starting to open trials in solid tumors. There's a range of solid tumors out there, like pancreatic cancer, ovarian cancer, and solid tumors as a whole are a lot more common than blood cancers. And this has also only been applied to a subset of blood cancers because they've only really been able to get it to work with one target. So they're certainly looking at solid tumors and other types of blood cancers as well, but we don't have that data yet. It's just too early.
Okay. Jennifer Cousin-Frankel, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks for talking with me.
Jennifer Cousin-Frankel writes about using genetically engineered immune cells to tackle cancer, one patient at a time, this week in Science.
Finally, today, I'm Linda Poon, and I'm speaking with David Grimm, online news editor for Science, about some of the recent stories from our online daily news site. So, Dave, in our first story, how ultramarathons may actually be easy on the body. Science reveals that ultramarathons actually cause less damage than running shorter races. So, first question, what makes a marathon an ultramarathon?
Well, Linda, if you really want to know what makes an ultramarathon, you'd probably want to look to the Tour du Géant in France, if I'm saying that right, and it may not be. My French isn't very great. This is a pretty extreme race. The participants walk and or run for about 330 kilometers in the Italian Alps. They're dealing with an increase in altitude of 24,000 meters, a time limit of 150 hours, and no required stops, which means that people run this race often without sleeping or sleeping very little. It's very extreme, very intense on the body. And the question with the study is, do the people that run these kinds of races actually do more damage to their bodies than people that run races that aren't so extreme? And the surprising answer is that they actually may be doing less damage to their body.
So when they're looking at these runners, what are they looking for?
They're looking for things like how fatigued these people are after the race. They also look at blood samples. They look for the presence of certain chemicals that can show stresses on the body, enzymes that are released in response to tissue damage, things like that.
All right, so you mentioned a sleep deprivation factor. So how did researchers account for that?
Well, what the researchers did is they actually looked at 15 runners that had run this race in 2011. And, you know, they wanted to know, because a lot of them don't sleep that well during the race, they actually compared them to a group of 8 trained runners who were limited to a similar amount of sleep, which could be as little as an hour and a half by the midpoint of the race and 9 hours by the end of the race. So they had people running the race, people that weren't running the race but weren't sleeping very well. And they also compared this to people that had run races that were maybe about half of the length of the Tour du Géant, just to see what the various impacts of these different routines were.
So how do these runners compare to others when it comes to muscle fatigue?
Well, what they found, which was really interesting, is that the runners that had run this really long French race showed less muscle fatigue. They had lower levels of inflammation in their blood than the runners that had run a race that was about half as long. They also had lower levels of creatine kinase, which is an enzyme released by muscles in response to tissue damage.
And what does sleep deprivation actually force competitors to do? Does it actually help them in this case then?
Well, that was the interesting thing. The researchers were trying to figure out, you know, what is it about running this really extreme race that seems to actually make people better off? And some of it appears to be the sleep deprivation. Actually going for long amounts of time without sleeping forced the runners to pace themselves more. It also forced them to move a lot slower, especially when they were really tired. And actually that seemed to take a lesser toll on the body than people that slept longer during races or that ran shorter races.
So does that mean we should make marathons longer to make them safer?
Well, I'm not going to be running this race anytime soon, but it does suggest that the body finds ways to compensate for these very extreme events. And in some cases, this compensation can actually protect the body.
Interesting. Well, in our next story, how gut bugs explain the link between obesity and cancer. So what do gut microbiota have to do with cancer?
Well, that's a good question. It turns out the microbes that live in our gut are responsible for a lot of diseases. Our gut microbes have been linked to inflammatory bowel disease, allergies, even heart disease. So perhaps it's no surprise that they may also be linked to cancer. The question in this study is, do they help explain this link between obesity and cancer? We know that people that are more obese are more prone to certain types of cancer, but scientists don't really understand the mechanism behind that.
So what did they do to study this?
Well, what they did was they studied this in mice, and they had mice that were lean and they grew up on a normal diet, and they had other mice that grew up on a very calorie-rich diet and became fat. And they exposed both of these groups of rodents to a cancer-causing chemical shortly after birth. And what they found is, similar to humans, only about 5% of the lean mice developed cancer, but all of the obese mice developed cancer. And when they looked a little further, they found that these mice actually had different compositions of microbes in their guts. The obese mice also had higher levels of a compound known as deoxycholic acid, or DCA, which is a byproduct left over after certain microbes break down bile acids produced by the liver. Now, it's known in humans that DCA can cause cancer by damaging DNA. So it was really interesting that they were finding these higher levels in the obese mice.
So how does diet play a role in cancer development?
Well, that was one of the questions the researchers had, you know, is it diet-based? But they found when they looked at another group of mice that were genetically engineered to become obese, regardless of the diet that they were fed, these mice also had higher levels of DCA, which suggests that it's the gut microbes themselves that are playing a role in the cancer rather than just the diet that these animals are eating.
So what does this mean for the future of cancer prevention in humans?
Well, it suggests that one way to go after cancer might be actually going after our gut microbes. And what was really interesting in the study is when they gave these obese mice an antibiotic, the animals showed a reduction in their cancer incidence. And also when they reduced their DCA levels, these mice also had a lower risk of cancer, which suggests that both of these are possible pathways for treating cancer in humans.
Finally, we go back in time and look at the sequenced genome of a 700,000-year-old horse. So, Dave, why is this a landmark study?
Well, Linda, it's a landmark because this is the oldest organism that's ever been sequenced. Before this, there was a fossil that was about 130,000 years old. This was from a polar bear jawbone that researchers were actually able to get DNA from. But this obviously is several hundred thousand years older. It's from a horse. It's from a bone that was found in Canada's Yukon Territory. Scientists were exploring a site that holds ice and volcanic ash that date back about 700,000 years. So they knew when they found this bone, it was very old, but they didn't think they could get DNA from it just because it's been really hard to get DNA from anything that old. And actually, some studies suggest that DNA doesn't even hang around for more than a million years. So scientists always sort of assumed that if they found something that old, that the DNA would be long gone.
So what does its DNA indicate?
Well, there's been some controversy in the study of equine evolution, and equines include horses, donkeys, and zebras, about exactly when they evolved, how related they are to each other. And also, there's been some mystery surrounding a horse known as the Tsarolski horse, which is considered the world's only remaining wild horse. There's been a source of controversy about this horse, about whether it's actually been mixed a little bit with domestic horses or about whether it is truly completely wild. And what the DNA revealed is that this horse seemed to share a common ancestor with the rest of the equus lineage, and that includes all donkeys, horses, and zebras. This common ancestor likely lived around 4 to 4.5 million years ago, which really starts to shed some light about when all these animals came into existence. But the DNA also suggests that the Tsarolski's horse is genetically distinct from all these other animals, and it did not mix with the domestic horse, suggesting this is a very unique animal.
So 700,000 years is a very long time. How is the ancient horse any different from today's modern ones?
Well, the scientists say this horse, and he was a he based on the DNA, was large but not as tightly muscled as a modern horse, maybe looking a little similar to today's Arabian horse.
And this technique is obviously very advanced. What other things can we learn from this new technique?
Well, the great thing about this, the really cool thing, is that they were able to sequence something that old, which suggests that other fossils that are found that old, we could potentially recover the DNA from them as well, and that could shed light not just on horse evolution, but potentially human evolution and the evolution of a whole host of other animals.
Well, these are three very interesting stories. What else do we have on the site this week?
Well, Linda, for Science Now, we've got a story about why whale veins don't collapse in the very deep depths that whales dive. Also a story about the similarities between our brains and the brains of honeybees. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a number of stories on the site this week, including a story about the first clinical trial with induced pluripotent stem cells and what implications that could have for human disease. For Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week our Science Live is about human cloning, the ethical and scientific issues related to that. And then we'll be taking a bit of hiatus for a couple months, and Science Live will return in September. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Great. Thanks so much, Dave.
Thanks, Linda.
David Grimm is the editor for Science's online daily news site. You can check out the latest news in the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the June 28th, 2013 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Linda Poon. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.